Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this Memorial Day, we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news in the context of past and present wars. We'll be joined by veterans of the First and Second Iraq Wars and the Vietnam War, focusing on what the wars achieved and the lasting effects these wars have had on veterans, as well as how much the governments who sent these vets off to war have kept their promises in terms of taking care of those we honour on Memorial Day. We'll begin with a veteran of the First Iraq War, Colonel Douglas McGregor, a decorated combat veteran and author of four books, who led the largest tank battle since World War II in the Gulf War and has since testified to the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He joins us to discuss the recent wars, what they achieved, and whether they were worth the sacrifice of lives and treasure. Then we'll speak with a veteran of the Second Iraq War, Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arabic linguist and is the author of Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. We'll discuss the issues that veterans from our latest wars face and the extent to which they are met, given the alarming number of young vets from Iraq and Afghanistan who are homeless and have drug problems. Then finally, we'll speak with Philip Butler, who was shot down over North Vietnam in 1965 and spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. We'll discuss how the Vietnam War haunted our politics for decades, and now the Iraq War appears to be doing the same for Republican presidential candidates, with a fellow POW of Phil's, Senator John McCain, championing the presidential run of his friend Lindsey Graham, who was calling for an additional 10,000 American troops to be sent to Iraq. And joining us now is Colonel Douglas McGregor, a decorated combat veteran and the author of five books, the latest of which is forthcoming, Margin of Victory. He was commissioned in the U.S. Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point, and served in the Gulf War, leading the largest tank battle since World War II. McGregor has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Douglas McGregor.
Thank you.
And on this Memorial Day, clearly goes back to the Civil War, the enormous sacrifices made here in the United States, brother against brother. And we do commemorate those that have made what's called the ultimate sacrifice. And, of course, nobody could argue that there was a greater sacrifice of Americans in that war. I think it's still one of the, if it's not the, in total, the greatest number of casualties, it certainly is per capita, wouldn't you say?
Well, the Civil War was devastating, almost a million casualties or more, certainly 600,000-700,000 dead. So it is by far the single most important military event in the history of the United States.
So in terms of the more recent wars, though, one of the things that I find puzzling is that the U.S. hasn't won a war since World War II, and we sort of, I don't know what happened here, whether we've just gotten used to it, but it doesn't seem to be a requirement anymore that you have to win a war.
Well, I think Memorial Day is a great time to consider what you've just mentioned, because, let's be frank, the World Wars, one and two, particularly World War II. World War II was a war that we could not avoid, that we were inevitably drawn into. We fought it with a goal in mind of ending the war itself. In other words, from the moment we entered it, the idea was to get it over with as soon as possible on the best terms that we could get. And we recognized towards the end of the war that it was not a perfect outcome, but it was still better than what had existed previously. And we celebrate that war as having made sense because it had a specific purpose, which was to defeat both Germany and Japan, to restore peace, and to restore peace and stability as soon as possible. All of the conflicts that we fought since then really haven't had any clear, unambiguous purpose, nor were they ever fought with the expectation of termination. Korea, of course, was something we didn't anticipate. Eisenhower ended it, fortunately, as soon as he could. We restored the status quo ante. But Vietnam, a war of choice, something we precipitated, as many of your listeners will recollect, on the basis of a lie, the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And then subsequently, until you get to Desert Storm in 1990-91, which falls somewhere in between war of choice and war of necessity. We really don't have any conflicts that were fought with a very clear, unambiguous, attainable objective. 1991 results in an end to the occupation of Kuwait, but of course we leave Saddam in place, and inevitably we're drawn back into that. But again, the conflicts that follow are not fought with a specific purpose. There are these lofty, unambiguous goals that we heard in the 1960s when we went into Vietnam of exporting liberal democracy and forging essentially new societies on foreign soil. These have all been titanic failures. All of these nation-building expeditions have ended in disaster. And I think we should pause and think about those very carefully on Memorial Day.
Well, in your case, though, Colonel McGregor, having fought in the Gulf War, surely it's an irony that you fought to preserve the Saudi royal family, who are now engaged in a war in Yemen, but whose Wahhabi ideology, which they've sent around the world thanks to all those petrodollars, is really at the heart of everything that's going wrong. If they destroyed Palmyra, the Islamic State, the historic Roman ruins, it will be because Palmyra represents, in Wahhabi ideology, a false idol. So, you know, you name it, Taliban, Boko Haram, al-Shabaab, al-Qaeda, and Islamic State, all spawned from Saudi ideology.
Well, I think that's true on the Sunni side. Of course, we shouldn't forget the Shiite Islamists either that are on the other side of this fight, in Iraq, Iran, and Syria, who also represent a rather bizarre view of the world. But I think your mention of Palmyra is very important, and many of your viewers may not appreciate this, but Palmyra was an outpost of Greco-Roman civilization, really established by the Roman legions. And as you walk across the Middle East and North Africa, what you see that remains of Rome and that great empire is all in ruins. Whereas if you travel to Spain, to France, across Italy, into Greece, into Germany, up into Great Britain, you see great societies, great civilizations built on the ruins of that great empire. And I think there's a lesson for us, that the attempts by Westerners to move into the region and to establish something that was foreign to the region, namely Western culture and civilization, have all failed. And we should not repeat this folly again. We did that again after 91 when we went back in 2003. We weren't satisfied to remove Saddam Hussein. We were intent on remaking this Iraqi state, which was always an artificial construct, as you know. And these artificial constructs, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Libya, all of these places are vanishing along with Yemen. And it remains to be seen whether or not the Saudi state, which is again another artificial construct in the aftermath of World War I, survives.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who's a decorated combat veteran, the author of 5 books, the latest which is the forthcoming book, Margin of Victory. He was commissioned in the U.S. Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point, and served in the Gulf War, leading the largest tank battle since World War II. McGregor has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. So do you think then you can... I can't say the heresy that these wars weren't worth it and the sacrifices weren't worth it. But I guess as a veteran, you can. But it does. It feels as if that's a difficult bubble to burst. And obviously nobody wants to tell a grieving parent or wife that their son or their daughter's life was sacrificed in vain for nothing, nothing that we can actually explain. Certainly no lasting legacy except death and destruction. I mean, it's an awful bitter pill to swallow, isn't it?
Well, there are large numbers of people in Washington who publicly have no intention under any circumstances of admitting the truth. And the truth is that the losses in Vietnam, the losses in Iraq and Afghanistan, and in other countries as well, certainly since the end of the Second World War, have been pointless, that we squandered American blood needlessly, along with enormous amounts of American treasure, resources, time, interest, commitment, and emotion. no one wants to say, as you point out, to the families of veterans who did not survive these encounters, the simple truth that it was not worth the effort and it should not have happened. But privately, people admit that here in Washington. They just don't have the courage to tell the truth. And we need that. We badly need that truth because we need to put an end to these pointless, self-defeating interventions where there is no expectation of termination, no clearly defined end state for victory, and where our strategic interests are questionable at best.
So let me be the devil's advocate then and put on my neocon clothes and make the argument that are you just going to let the bloodletting continue indiscriminately in the Middle East, and particularly if the Islamic State destroys this World Heritage Site, Palmyra, which they probably will do, is that something that as a civilized beings on this planet that we can simply turn a blind eye to?
Well, I personally deeply regret the destruction of any of these Roman ruins or Greek ruins in Anatolia, the Middle East, throughout the entire region, because, as I said, they represent the achievement of a great civilization. But at the same time, I don't think we can ask American soldiers, sailors, airmen, or Marines with a clear conscience to put their lives on the line and die for the preservation of these ruins. If anything, the destruction of these ruins is probably the final act in a long process of rejection. Rejection of Western culture and civilization that has been rampant in the region for hundreds, if not more than 1,000 years. So that's the first answer to your question. The second part is there is, in a sort of perverse way, some good news. And that news is that you have the radicalized elements on both sides, the Sunni and the Shia, in places like Iraq and Syria and Yemen, killing each other. And if they are killing each other, they are not killing people in the West. They are not killing Israelis. And that's a good thing. And frankly, as long as they want to persist in this, I certainly have no intentions of involving ourselves and interrupting it.
So what happens, though, if you walk away from the Middle East, which I guess you're talking about, except you wouldn't walk away from Israel, obviously?
Well, you don't have to worry too much about Israel. Israel has behaved very prudently throughout this entire process. You haven't seen the Israelis unleash the Israeli Defense Force at any great strength in any direction. If they have involved themselves briefly in Syria, it's from the air to destroy something which they've identified as an unambiguous threat to them. So I think we ought to follow the Israeli model, frankly, and stay out of it. And what will happen in the Middle East is what's happened many, many times in the past. The regional actors will eventually align in a way that produces an outcome. And historically, certainly over the last several centuries, 500 or 600 years, whenever the Shiites from Persia have involved themselves in the Middle East, the Ottoman Turks, the Sunni Turks, have driven them out. Turkey is the regional military superpower. It has a larger army and larger forces in general than any other member of NATO. And if it decides to intervene on the Sunni side, it can put a quick end to what's happening in Iraq. The problem we have is we don't seem to understand that from the vantage point of the Saudis and the Turks, the Sunnis again, ISIS may not be attractive and it may be in some ways reprehensible morally, but it is vastly superior to the alternative, which is essentially permanent Shiite control of both the area we call Iraq and Syria, and that's something they won't tolerate.
Well, what would you do then about China? That's obviously the threat that that the neocons can actually get some traction on. It's pretty hard to get America back into Iraq, even though Lindsey Graham wants to send 10,000 new troops. But there's this general sense that this new economic juggernaut has taken over the world and its military is eventually going to match ours. And now you have a situation, by the way, in the South China Sea where the U.S. is flying over these artificial islands that the Chinese are trying to build in the Spratlys in order to put a base down there. So already you've got some friction going.
Well, it's an interesting topic to discuss because I've spent some time in Northeast Asia, and I think most people that have don't reach the same conclusions about the Chinese. The Chinese are preeminently an economic power. They are not preeminently a military power. They don't have a martial culture. And to be perfectly blunt, Chinese history is not filled with endless military victories. On the contrary, for more than 70% of China's history over the last 1,000 years, China has been ruled by foreigners, non-Chinese, who conquered them. I think the Chinese, as they look outward from their country, they look away from the coastline, they still fear, rightly or wrongly, the Japanese. The Japanese invasion and conquest of China during the Second World War between 1937 and 1945 left a permanent mark on the psyche of China. The Chinese are building up their coastal defenses with the goal of ensuring that what they experienced from 37 to 45 will not happen again. They also have a long experience in the 19th century with one of your favorite organizations, the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy was quite adept at isolating and then penetrating China through its great rivers and harbors, particularly through the South China Sea. And China doesn't want a repetition of that, and they see the United States Navy in many ways as the natural strategic successor to the Royal Navy. And with all of the discussion that went on for a couple of years in Washington about air-sea battle being directed at China, the Chinese understandably reacted with great concern and have invested very heavily in the strike weapons and defenses on their coasts and in a defensive navy to deal with it. And then finally, China is desperately dependent upon natural resources and materials that China does not have. And most of those flow through the South China Sea to China. That means through the Straits of Malacca and around through India and the Suez, all the way from Africa. So they desperately need to preserve that lifeline, and they're building the semblance of a navy, not on the scale that we have in the United States, but a navy that's designed to preserve and protect that. And this business about the South China Sea and who owns it is bound up with it. But those disputes between principally China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, are disputes that don't involve us and disputes that can be handled by the people in the region. The notion that China is this overwhelming power that everyone shrinks from attacking is untrue. Just a couple of years ago, the Chinese established an oil rig in Vietnamese waters. Some of your listeners may recall the Vietnamese population rose in anger, burned down Chinese factories, and effectively drove Chinese businesses and Chinese people completely out of Vietnam. China did not go to war with Vietnam. China moved its oil rig. So I think we should walk away from the notion that what China is doing down there, first of all, necessarily affects us. It doesn't, as long as we have freedom of navigation. And secondly, that if we stand aloof and not participate in this squabble, we may actually be in a position to assist in the resolution of these claims, which are longstanding, reaching back hundreds, some would even argue more than 1,000 years, between the various actors. But this is not something that requires the use of American military power.
Well, Colonel McGregor, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this Memorial Day.
Well, thank you, and God bless you for doing it, and God bless our veterans. And remember, they deserve better than they've been getting from their government for the last 50 years.
And again, I'm speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who's a decorated combat veteran and the author of 5 books, the latest which is the forthcoming book, Margin of Victory. McGregor was commissioned in the U.S. Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point, and served in the Gulf War, leading the largest tank battle since World War II. Colonel McGregor has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with a veteran of the Second Iraq War.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating, and you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, Yeah, that build all the bombs. Yeah, that hide behind walls. Yeah, that hide behind discs. I just don't want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us on this Memorial Day is Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arabic linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kayla Williams.
Thank you so much for having me.
And how are you and your family observing Memorial Day?
We are actually spending some time with our neighbors and grilling and spending time with our children and being thankful that we are able to enjoy all of those things.
Well, in many ways, your husband was a subject of your book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. So could you just give our audience a quick summary of the story of your book and of your life?
Absolutely. So I enlisted in the Army after I had already graduated from college and worked for several years and was assigned Arabic to become a linguist. And took part of the initial invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. While I was there, I met the man who became my husband not long before he sustained a penetrating traumatic brain injury. Shrapnel from a roadside bomb went through his skull, traveled forward and exited near his right eye. So it was very touch and go whether or not he would even survive. And he was released from the hospital about the same time as the rest of us got back from the Middle East. We started dating then, got married about a year later. And so my second book chronicles his injury and our family's very long and winding and difficult road from that war injury to healing and recovery and love. And so that's why we're so grateful that he is not among the fallen who are memorialized on this special day, because he came so very close to being killed in that explosion, and we're just incredibly thankful that he's still here today and that we are able to commemorate those who did lose their lives but still are so lucky that we can actually enjoy the time that we have together.
But in terms of veterans and those that survived, I know this is a day when we think of those who made the ultimate sacrifice. However, there are so many young veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars who are homeless and who have drug problems. Here in Los Angeles, there's something extraordinary. I think it's 140,000 homeless vets. I can't remember the exact statistics, but don't hold me to it. But whatever it is, it's an appalling and absolutely disgraceful number.
Yes, homelessness is a real problem for a minority of veterans who are struggling. I mean, over a lifetime, those who have served in the military are more highly employed, more highly educated, and more highly paid. But for a minority, either the transition out of the military is extremely rocky and difficult, or either wartime trauma or some other mental health concern or issue that they're facing becomes a chronic condition. When we talk a lot about homelessness and mental health issues in veterans, I think a lot of people, they think immediately of today's younger generation of veterans, but these are not problems that are exclusive to young veterans. Really, every generation of veterans has been affected, and so it's really important to me that we not focus our efforts exclusively on younger veterans, but also remember that there may be those from prior eras who are also struggling. And the VA has been working very hard to tackle the problem of homelessness. And throughout the nation, there's been a real transformation in how homelessness advocates advocates for the homeless are approaching problems more generally to this housing first approach that is very successful compared to other methods that were used in the past. And we see some cities who have that have already eradicated homelessness among the veterans population, and others are making tremendous strides. So this really these amazing collaborations that are going on between the Department of Veterans Affairs, between the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and local community efforts, both at the state government level, state and local governments, and also nonprofit organizations coming together to work to end this problem, which is a really amazing thing. And it's so important to me that people remember that veterans came from communities around the country and then we returned to them. So this is something that people can work to solve at their local level, in their own local communities, in a way they can come together.
And again, I'm speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arabic linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. So in terms of your own husband, clearly with wounds that almost took his life and obviously would require an enormous amount of rehabilitation, how's your experience been with the VA?
Well, I would say that when he was first injured back in 2003, the first few years after his injury, neither the Department of Defense nor the Department of Veterans Affairs were prepared to handle those with severe injuries like he had, or the volume of wounded warriors who were coming home. So it took a lot of advocacy on the part of many tireless people to help patch some of those gaps and improve the systems and services that are available for wounded warriors. The VA, several years after my husband was injured, developed a polytrauma system of care that's specifically designed to assist those who have multiple forms of injury, like my husband did, and deal with those injuries in a team approach, where a variety of care providers come together and collaborate instead of being kind of really split up. So there have been a lot of improvements in many, many ways since he was injured, and I've seen that firsthand. But there are definitely ongoing improvements that can still be made, and I sincerely hope that everyone will advocate to continue getting enough funding to the agencies that are charged with caring for those who have been injured in service to our country.
And Kayla, what is this group that advertises all the time on television,
Wounded Warrior Project?
Yeah. Is that so? They're obviously not the VA. So what's their function, and why are they? Are they? I mean, I'm curious to know why they are out there, frankly, if the VA handles these issues.
So there are actually over some estimates. There are 40,000 nonprofits devoted to helping service members, veterans, or military families in some way or another. There are groups that take wounded warriors kayaking or fly fishing or horseback riding. There are those that help make sure that they are processing, getting their claims to VA submitted properly with all the right supporting evidence. And just so many people coming together from communities around the country to help take care of our service members, veterans, and military families. Unfortunately, some of them are not as careful in terms of their stewardship of these charitable donations as others. So I would always encourage people who want to donate to those organizations to go online to some of the rating organizations like Charity Navigator or others and make sure that the organization they want to donate to is one that is a responsible steward of those charitable dollars. The Wounded Warrior Project is one that has come under some criticism from some veterans groups for not always spending money as fast as some people would like and maybe not being as collaborative as some would appreciate. There's an article in the newspaper recently about how vigorously they will pursue other nonprofit organizations that they think may have names that are too similar to their own. So, you know, it is the nonprofit world, like many other industries, has its own quirks and conflicts and challenges, but there are a number of terrific organizations out there working to fill in the gaps. And it's important to understand that the Department of Veterans Affairs, by law, from, you know, that comes down from Congress, they can only do certain things. They have very specific mandates that they are meant to fulfill. So they provide disability compensation, for example. They provide health care, for example. But I think most Americans would agree that they don't necessarily want the Department of Veterans Affairs to, say, buy baseball tickets for troops or veterans. And so some of these nonprofits can step up and work to get donations of extra baseball tickets or whatever and take those folks out so that they can have a nice time, and even while injured or dealing with things, that they can go out and still enjoy spending time with their families. So there are, I think, very valid things for nonprofits to do that are not government functions. And it's also a way that we, as members of the community, can come together and try to bridge the divide between the all-volunteer force, in which, you know, at this point, less than 1% of the population is choosing to serve in the military, compared to when there was a draft for World War II or Vietnam, when far higher numbers participated. So a lot of people can feel as if there's a divide, and these nonprofit organizations are a way that people can reach out across that divide and form greater connections with those who are serving.
Well, I'm glad you've answered that question, because I've seen a lot of these ads, particularly the Wounded Warrior Project ads, where they use these kind of washed up celebrities and tug at your heartstrings, and it sort of raised some questions in my mind. So I think people should be very careful about who they give money to. And what was the name of the way that you check out these charities?
There are several online. One of them is Charity Navigator. That's the one that springs most quickly to my mind. But there are a couple of others, and they try to be pretty transparent about how they rate organizations and lay out what they look at, what percentage of donated money goes to the cause versus to fundraising, things like that.
Right. So a couple of strange things have happened in the news, and I just wanted to run them by you, Kayla. You may or may not have caught them. There was an extraordinary case now where a U.S. Army sergeant was killed by a roadside bomb in Iraq, and lo and behold, a taxi driver in London gets arrested because of forensics. They've managed to find fingerprints on the bomb and traced this fellow to driving a cab in London, and he's been tried in a civil court. So to some extent, you know, we know that the Iraq war is haunting some of the presidential candidates trying to get their narrative straight about it. But do you think it's coming back in a way, and it's likely to come back even more so in the 2016 presidential race?
That's what it looks like right now. Obviously, I have no idea what's going to happen. If the situation there gets much worse or much better, it could change the narrative significantly. But I've, quite frankly, been astonished at the level of support that I've seen in poll data among the American public for a willingness to put boots back on the ground. It's, frankly, it's very... very surprising to me, given the way that our involvement has gone in the past, that people would be so willing to go back in. But it is difficult, I think, for politicians to know how to handle it, given the complexities of both public polling and knowing that trying to work in a restrained funding environment and how wars are extremely expensive. So there are so many different narratives that I think they're going to struggle with at the same time, depending on which side of the aisle they're on. And it's not a public debate that I would relish having if I were in any of their shoes.
Well, but it's pretty strange, isn't it, Kayla, to think that you've got the Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, criticizing the Iraqi army, saying that they simply didn't want to show up in Ramadi, and that's why the city of Ramadi was lost. So I'd be very, if I was in the service, I'd be a little leery about going in to fight a war for a country that our own Secretary of Defense is criticizing their own army.
I've heard those criticisms for over a decade now, so they aren't that surprising to me,
right,
frankly.
So back to the to the personal in terms of your experience and your husband's experience. What's your sense of this idea that a veterans group has to have a minute of silence? I think they've been trying for years to get this into the kind of national consciousness. And I take it the minute of silence would be on Memorial Day at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time. Are you aware of this effort?
I am. And I think that it is terrific to remind people that Memorial Day is a day of commemoration for those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. But I also, sometimes I'm getting a feeling lately as if there's kind of a culture of outrage developing among some components of the veterans community. People are upset about Under Armour putting an image on a shirt. They're upset about people posing in ways that they think are disrespectful. And there's just this constant drumbeat of being irritated. And I'm not completely convinced that as veterans standing on our front lawns and shaking our fists and yelling at the kids these days is the best way to get our message across. And so I'm not, that's not where I am today. We will, while we're enjoying this holiday with our neighbors and celebrating the freedoms that we are lucky enough to enjoy, we will pause to remember those who have given their lives. But it is not my opinion that everybody should spend the day in the entire day in mourning. I think that people should feel comfortable celebrating the fact that we are Americans and treat it as a piece that I read said suggested more as a wake than as a funeral, and raise a glass while celebrating. Of course, it is a day of great tragedy to those who have personally lost someone, and I will extend my sympathy to those people who I know who have been so personally affected. But I do think that people don't need to feel guilty about enjoying the first real holiday weekend of summer.
I like that idea, a wake instead of a funeral. And, of course, the origins of Memorial Day go back to the Civil War, don't they?
They do indeed.
And that was brother against brother here in the United States.
Yes, something that I think about often when people are astonished at how bad things are in Iraq. It did take our own nation many, many years to decide what kind of country we wanted to be and to work out how to handle the rights of minorities. And as you can see by some of the ongoing protests, it is not clear that we have managed that perfectly ourselves.
And indeed, I think that war still it has the highest number of casualties in American history, just that war itself.
By percentage, I think that is definitely true.
Right. Well, Kayla, I thank you very much for joining us on this Memorial Day. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for taking the time, and I hope you will raise a glass for the wake.
Well, I'm from Australia, so we're familiar with raising a glass, so that won't be too difficult for me.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Kayla.
Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arabic linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She is a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle, More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. And her latest is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a veteran of the Vietnam War who was shot down in 1965 over North Vietnam and spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with a veteran of the Vietnam War who was shot down over North Vietnam in 1965 and spent 8 years as a prisoner of war.
We have to do it all the way through. We want no more of that. You can't.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today, Phil is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Philip Butler.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here again.
And on this Memorial Day, we've been talking with vets from the Gulf War, the First Iraq War, and the Second Iraq War, and now we're going to the Vietnam War, and of course, spending 8 years as a POW in North Vietnam certainly puts you up there with probably the longest serving veterans in terms of sacrifice in that war, short of those who didn't come back. So your fellow POW, Senator John McCain, is championing the presidential run of his friend Lindsey Graham, who is calling for an additional 10,000 American troops to be sent to Iraq. So given that the ghosts of Vietnam haunted our politics for decades, and now the ghosts of the Iraq are haunting our politics, what's your sense of whether we're going to go back into the Iraq war with boots on the ground?
I sincerely certainly hope not. It's just ridiculous. I thought after Vietnam, for a very short period of time, a few years there, that we had probably learned our lessons about getting into senseless wars. And Vietnam was one of the most disastrous and senseless wars that this country ever decided to get into, with 58,000 of our good, our best and brightest killed over there, several hundred thousand wounded and maimed in one way or another, and not to mention 2 to 4 million Vietnamese having been killed and untold millions suffering in many different ways over there. But we didn't learn. We started up the same thing again in Iraq. It's amazing to hear all these so-called candidates. I guess you call them candidates. They don't sound like people who have very many smarts to me. And John McCain leading the way, I guess, with Lindsey Graham. And these guys being asked whether or not they, knowing what they know today, would they do Iraq, and they can't give a sensible answer. I mean, it's really pathetic. It's just pathetic to see that this is what one side of our politic has to put up to run. For president of the United States, it's actually embarrassing when you talk to people in other countries. They can't figure us out. They can't figure out why we're still, you know, muddling around with all sorts of social issues that should have been solved a long time ago, and why we keep getting to all these wars. But anyway, don't let me go on too long here, Ian.
Okay.
You got me into a rant. I'm sorry.
No. I'll ease you down from your soapbox here. So tell me then, what is it in our nature then that would distinguish us from others? The British, funnily enough, in this last election in Britain, one of the sort of themes of the election was, this was argued by the Labour Party candidate, that somehow Britain had lost its importance as the great Atlantic ally of the United States, and we were becoming irrelevant, and our army was cut down to the bone, and we're not going to be a player anymore on the world stage. And you get the feeling the British people are perfectly happy with that. They've had, centuries of empire, and look where it's led. So why do you think we are not having a discussion in this country about the empire versus the republic?
That's a really good question. I don't know. As bad as our infrastructure is, and I'm sure everybody driving around is slamming into potholes and driving across bridges that could collapse at any moment, and trains that go off derailing, and all the stuff keeps coming up, on the news and everything. But I don't know. somehow or another, most, I guess the majority of Americans seem to be anesthetized in some fashion. They certainly, I don't think Memorial Day means anything to 98% of American, or make it 99%, because only 1% are actually involved in some fashion as a serving member or a family member in the military. So this Memorial Day is supposed to be for, our deceased, our veterans who were killed in wars past. It's no more than a 3-day holiday, you know, to go out, I guess, and barbecue and picnic and drive around and have fun and just forget the whole thing. It does seem that maybe our British cousins are doing pretty much the same thing. They just shocked us all by reelecting the Conservative government, and one wonders if Britain will stay a member of the European Union, which I think would be a disaster for them and also for Europe and ultimately for us as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Philip Butler, who is a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today, Phil is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. So in terms of the ghosts of Vietnam coming back in a way, in terms of the ghosts of Iraq, what's your sense then of the incredibly sort of short learning curve? I mean, our previous guest who served in the Iraq War, we pointed out that, of course, the Memorial Day was started after the Civil War to memorialize all of those boys from in blue and in gray in this fratricidal war. And she pointed out, well, you know, we have a hard time understanding that what's going on in Iraq in terms of a civil war, and yet we had our own civil war here in the United States. So in terms of what got us into Vietnam and what got us into Iraq, there does seem to be at least a consistency where there's an absolute disregard for history. There's no sense that history, in fact, as far as the American media is concerned, history in Vietnam began with the Vietnam War, and history with Iraq began with the Iraq War. As long as we're in war there, we learn everything about the country, but we don't learn anything about the country before we go in.
We don't know a thing, and we certainly, you know, I doubt that there are very, very few Americans walking around who know the difference between the Shia and Sunni Islam. I confess I don't. I mean, I know, a little bit about the history of Islam, but the intricacies of the Quran are certainly foreign to me. So it seems to me like Syrian, Iraqi, and, Muslim boys and girls should be sorting out their problems over there. If they want to redo the geography, which certainly they should, because it was done for them without asking them after World War One. But if they want to redo the geography over there into Shiistan and Sunnistan and Kurdistan, I think that'd be just fine. And if they want to fight and kill each other and have a bloody go at it, then so be it. I don't think we should be involved in it. We had our own here in 1861 to 65, where we did that and killed off a very large share of our population in doing it. So it shouldn't come as any surprise that they're about doing that. But the surprise to me is, why in the heck should we be involved in it? It just seems to be that this country is very, very good at getting into wars, and it's hopelessly inept at getting out of them.
Well, what role do you think, though, the military-industrial complex plays in this, given that we haven't won a war since World War II, and it doesn't seem to matter that you don't win wars anymore, and it's almost as though war is a necessary afterthought to keep the machinery of defense contracting going?
Well, sadly, I think You kind of hit the nail on the head there. We've absolutely lost control of our democracy. Our elected officials in Washington are not their constituents. Their constituents are the people who fund their elections. And so, of course, the war machinery, Eisenhower was correct, absolutely correct. And if he were alive today, I think he'd be astounded at how far beyond even his fears went, with the military-industrial complex. But all these guys that can't answer the question about Iraq, well, they're not going to say anything bad about war, any wars that we've been in, because all the people who make all kinds of war machinery, make a useless airplane like an F-35, they're going to vote for it in their district, and that's where they get their money. But it's not us. Just for the first time this year, my wife and I had a discussion, and we've decided that we're not going to send any money to any political candidates beyond those that are our local candidates, our supervisors and our local elected officials, because it's just like throwing money into the wind. It's hopeless when they've got a PAC that will fund politicians on either side, on both sides, for millions and millions of dollars. And so that's who they're beholden to. They're not beholden to the American people anymore.
Well, one of the things I've heard from some specialists who follow the so-called self-proclaimed Islamic State and speak Arabic and know what's happening on the ground there as much as anybody does, apparently amongst the Islamic State fighters, there's a certain pride in the fact that, a terrorist on a motorcycle is killed by a $700,000 JDAM, And they sort of, it's almost a badge of honor that the Americans are spending that much money just to kill one of us. I mean, what a bizarre world.
It is. It is a terribly bizarre world. And, I just have to, before we end this conversation, I have to say what I've always said in my talks with you, Ian, and that is that so many people confuse the war with the warrior, and my mantra has always been to hate the war but love the warrior. We've just got to support and love these young people that we're sending off to these things, and the best way to support them is to join together and put a stop to all these stupid, senseless wars that are killing people on our side and their side.
Well, how do we do that, Phil? I mean, let's get practical here.
Well, I don't know that I'm a practical guy. You might be talking to the wrong person, Ian, because here I am tilting at windmills. I'm the president of my Veterans for Peace chapter, and we've been trying mightily since 1991 here in our community to educate our community about the costs of war. And our Veterans for Peace national organization is going to have its, 20th or so convention in San Diego in August. And that's what that organization does. We have close to 200 chapters around the country and a few in foreign countries. But it just requires a concerted effort to try to keep doing what's the right thing. And you ask for practical, I suppose I'm lacking in that area, Ian.
Well, it's actually an unfair question because it gets to the root of the great puzzles about American democracy. Why does so few Americans vote? Why do those that don't vote not recognize how much their interests would be served if they do vote? And a lot of people who do vote against their own interests. So, we obviously have a very imperfect democracy, but at the end of the day, it'll only be people power versus money power, because as you pointed out earlier, money has taken over our system, and they don't care about us; they only care about the people who give them money.
That's right. I think in the end, Ron, Americans are not so stupid that at the end of the day, they feel intuitively helpless. And that it's not worth their time to vote, let's say, between, I don't know, Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, you know, or Bobby Jindal, or I don't know, you know, one of these people. But either way that it pans out, the military-industrial complex will keep going on. So that's the question: is how do we get into the bottom of this thing and put a stop to it? And I have to say that the only thing I know is to do my best in writing and speaking and tilting at windmills, trying to educate people about the cost of war. And I did recently, I know you might not know, I wrote an autobiography. It's called Three Lives of a Warrior. And my three lives, the first one was learning to be a warrior, and the second one was a warrior in war, and the third life that I write about is being a warrior for peace and social justice. But it's on Amazon if anybody wants to look it up, Three Lives of a Warrior.
So Three Lives of a Warrior on Amazon, is it it's a recent book?
Yeah, it's about, I think, 3 or 4 years old, something mm-hmm. like that.
But it's available at Amazon, Three Lives of a Warrior by
yep.
Philip Butler. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Phil Butler.
Thank you, Ian, and I really appreciate what you're doing. The same thing. You have a bigger windmill to tilt at than I do with all your listeners out there, but bless your heart for doing it. I very much appreciate you and your efforts at public radio here.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He's completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today, Phil is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. This has been a special background briefing on Memorial Day. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can scroll down to the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now.